Today's podcast is brought to you by the Emmy Award-winning Prime original series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, starring Rachel Brosnahan and Alex Borstein. The new season of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel returns December 5th on Amazon Prime Video.
Hello, and welcome back to The Awardist from Entertainment Weekly. We're taking you inside this year's best contenders for the industry's biggest awards, from the Golden Globes to the Oscars. I'm your host, Shayna Naomi Crockmall. I'm the digital director at EW, and I'm joined this week by two of my most film-obsessed and knowledgeable colleagues, Pia Sinha Roy, a senior writer who's covering movies for EW. Hi, Pia.
Hey.
And Bill Keith, deputy editor of the magazine.
Hi.
This podcast is part of our comprehensive awards coverage in the magazine, online at EW. We're talking about the actors, the films, TV shows that should win, which of those actually will win, and why. Last week, we talked about Golden Globes, kicked things off a little bit with our colleague, Kristen Baldwin, who's our TV critic. And today, we're going to dive right into a very big picture, best picture debate. Later in the show, we're also going to stake out some bold predictions for nominations and maybe even winners. I feel like if we're going to talk about awards starting in November, we should be willing to talk about how we think it's going to end in February or at least take a few stabs at it. So that's where we're going this week. Welcome to The Awardist. Pia is also writing a weekly column for EW.com called The Awardist. And this week, I'm really excited by what you're writing about this week. It's kind of a different kind of best picture Oscar showdown. So instead of some of the dueling divas you might see in an All About Eve kind of year, even La La Land versus Moonlight, we're kind of zooming way out to talk about escapism versus realism. Pia, tell me a little bit more about what your theory is here.
So I just like to take a look at the kind of, as you mentioned, the real big picture of the best picture race. And just looking back to, I started looking back to the years that we've had up to 10 nominees in the best picture category. That started in 2010. So just looking from that year onwards and seeing what type of films have actually won out. And so often you see the kind of finalists, that shortlist and the favorites come down to movies that are fairly divided between something that's a very escapist story and something that's very grounded and reflective of what's going on in reality at that time. And so obviously these two things can be sort of manipulated to fit, you know, different types of films that have come along. But it's just been interesting to see that picture because I think it also reflects where our society is at and what people's appetites are there for. Because as we realize, you know, movies are what people go to see to escape the world. And sometimes they embrace, sometimes especially voters really like to embrace a film that absolutely makes them completely escape into a fantastical world where they don't have to think about their reality. And at other times they like to see something that shines a real spotlight on something that is they've been thinking about perhaps and has been in the conversation.
So this year, we're going to get to this year in a little bit. We've got some obvious kind of contenders on both sides of that. We've got the sweeping tragic love story of A Star Is Born, the nostalgic memories of Roma, The Favorite, which is kind of a twisted nightmare. And then we even have something as vibrant as Black Panther, which is exciting to kind of have in this conversation, that are all in their own ways kind of escapist. And then we've got Green Book, First Man, Black Klansman, all very much more grounded in reality. Before we dig into those, let's take a kind of like look back. So 2010, and as you pointed out, we're starting where they expanded the Best Picture nominations for up to 10, although we haven't really ever had a year with 10.
We've never had 10 nominees.
Yet. No. There's always maybe, potential.
There's always potential.
Year. but let's start where you started at 2010. So take me through what happened that year. Who won, escapism or realism?
So this was actually one of my favorite ones because the Best Picture race basically came down to The Hurt Locker, which is directed by Kathryn Bigelow, and James Cameron's Avatar. You can't get more escape versus real here in that race. And also, I just thought it was very interesting this year because James Cameron and Kathryn Bigelow used to be married, and so it really added another layer, and it was also a female director going up against a male director in a very male-dominated world. So there's so many layers into this race, and everyone was very curious to see what was going to win out. And for those of you who don't remember, Avatar is obviously the biggest film like in box office history, basically, but it was the Hurt Locker that voters opted for, and on that night at least, realism did win.
Which wasn't just like a little realistic. I mean, that was like a really intense, very, very gritty film. Bill, do you have any recollections from the 2010 race?
Yeah, no, I do. I was in my 40s. No, it was a weird. I mean, I'm looking back at this list. It was kind of interesting because beyond those two movies, like it's like we had The Blind Side in there. Was nominated, and Education was nominated, Up was nominated. But I think when it came down to it, there were two movies that just had a like very significant heft to them for different reasons. And it was both of these movies, The Hurt Locker and Avatar. And I think, you know, what it comes down to is, I mean, we can talk about this for all the years, but I think when the realism story, at the end of it, you feel victorious. That's like that. It's sort of like to jump ahead, but basically, it's like when you have something Spotlight, like that.
We're
realism.
Not there yet. We're
I know,
yet.
But I'm just saying, honestly, like in this case, like The Hurt Locker, you just it feels like the more important movie than Avatar. So it's like weird to think about something as significant as The Hurt Locker ultimately going up against a bunch of blue-faced aliens.
So you're sort of saying that it's so not just that it was real, but it was the gravitas and the realness of it's not just that it's realistic,
yeah,
but that it's actually taking on something weighty of real portents.
Yeah. And so when it's you can look at Avatar in a vacuum and talk about all the achievements that it has, but when you start talking yourself about Avatar versus The Hurt Locker,
the idea of there being a best picture Avatar.
Exactly. Like Avatar should be given all the technical awards.
All right. Moving on. 2011.
So 2011, we saw some, again, like a sort of interesting collection of films. But for me, I think the race sort of really came down to, if I remember correctly from that year, it really did come down to Darren Aronofsky's Natalie Portman star Black Swan, which is a very like dark, nightmarish ballet fantasy thriller.
A movie I never wanted to watch twice, but really was happy I saw it once.
Yeah, that is from my one time of watching it, that recollection. That's what I left with.
I feel weird now because I know what it's like to feel like that about a movie, but I definitely saw this one at least 3 or 4 times.
Oh my God, really?
It was just so beautiful, and weird, but like in a really rewarding way.
Yeah, it was a very, I kind of get it. It's a very beautiful, kind of surreal tale and story, and really like getting into, you know, the nightmare of someone's, I don't know, crazy mind in this world. And then you have this very grounded period drama, The King's Speech, starring Colin Firth as, if I remember correctly, it was King George the Sixth.
You're the one who should definitely know.
Right? King George
Elizabeth's
the
dad.
Elizabeth's dad, right. As I like
to call it.
George the Stutterer, I believe he was known.
Oh, yes. Goodness. Yeah, well, that was part of the story.
Yeah, and, that was the whole.
So it was. So I also think, you know, that story was very much, you know, a person having to overcome their own obstacles to take on, you know, this huge responsibility. And I think this is, again, a year where we saw that real journey and that real kind of overcoming of that obstacle that won out. So The King's Speech did win that year. And again, you can kind of see why it did, but I would argue that Black Swan for me was perhaps the more talked about film that year.
Yeah, it was sort of, I feel like everyone had a really lovely time with The King's Speech. But like, look, that was the same year as The Social Network. And so that didn't win. And I feel like, again, it's the same point that I made earlier, but it's like you didn't walk out of The Social Network feeling victorious for something or somebody the way you did with The King's Speech. And it was like, well, that was a triumph of will or...
And the stakes were high. I mean, it was England and like the times that he had to be able to speak eloquently to. Yeah. So I guess that sort of meets, Bill, your earlier point that, like, it doesn't, not just real, but it has to have weight to it. Does period realism pack the same punch as a contemporary realistic?
I think that's perhaps a really good comparison with The Social Network versus The King's Speech. The Social Network, though, I think, never really... It was very well, like, received, and people were talking about it a lot. The problem is the characters, and because they're like, these are real people, and they weren't likable.
Right, totally.
You can't really feel sympathy for any of these very arrogant tech entrepreneurs. So, you know, that's no reflection on what my real thoughts are. It's just obviously the portrayals of Mark Zuckerberg here and, you know, the other people involved in the founding of Facebook and then what happens with it. You know, no one's really a winner. It's all a real like a money-driven thing. And I think that alone, it's a very interesting story, but you don't feel like you're supporting someone.
No.
King's Speech, you're really rooting for Colin Firth, you know, to like overcome
his
obstacles.
And we're always rooting for Colin Firth.
I'm always rooting for Colin Firth.
I think the other thing that, like, not to muddy it, but it's basically like period has a better chance in the realism realm because there's a dash of fantasy to it.
Mm-hmm,
like, if you're doing contemporary realism, you're presenting, like, a story about what happened.
Like Hurt
Locker. You don't have, like, 50 years to look back and sort of do the inspired by true events thing. So, like, it helps, I think, a bit of, like, distance from the reality that you're discussing so you can get look a little bit rosier.
So 2012, speaking of period.
This was one of my first years properly covering the Oscars, so I just really remember this one sticking out for me because we had some great movies like The Help came out that year and obviously was really well received. We had a movie like The Descendants, which people were... you know, it's very intimate, like family drama and starring George Clooney. And that one also received a lot of love. And then you had Midnight in Paris, which was this like very dreamy escapist world. And people really enjoyed that. And then you have The Artist, which is a black and white film starring unknown people. It's sort of relatively unknown Jean Dujardin at that time. And then Uggy the Dog. And this is just
thank you for recognizing his work.
Special dog Oscar.
I had to recognize Uggy. I met him once, and that still is one of my all time favorite moments. But
good interview.
Oh, brilliant! My favorite interview ever. And I think that was it. This is a black and white tale of old Hollywood. It was nostalgic. It's beautiful. There's dance numbers. It sweeps you away. And then when you're looking at a story like The Help, that was a period drama based on a novel, and it really delved into race relations there. And I think I thought both had a really good shot, but I'm not surprised that... Oh, and I've got to say Moneyball was also...
Moneyball, which is like The Social Network of 2012.
Exactly. It's the sports social network, basically.
Yeah.
So I just think, again, with like the likability here and the escapism factor, for me, The Artist captured that. Like everyone was swept away into the beauty of The Artist, and amazingly, that won out that year. So in that year, escapism won.
Yeah. I mean, and it was also, you know, Hollywood loves Hollywood. So they're very easy to get a vote for that. That was also the year of the best acceptance speech, when Jim Rash was making fun of Angelina Jolie when he was standing on stage for The Descendants. Just as a reminder of what happened in 2012.
Thank you, Bill. I forgot about that. That's great. I'm glad you're here to remind us of these moments.
All right, 2013. Interesting crop.
Yes. So 2013, we had Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained, which is his kind of slavery revenge tale. We had a movie like Silver Linings Playbook, which obviously Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper received a lot of love for. And we had, you know, this incredible, fantastical reimagining of Life of Pi by Ang Lee in all of these are in the Best Picture category. And then we had this incredible independent film, Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is a Sundance breakout, if I remember correctly. And it was, I would argue, it was so...
I love this movie so much.
It really was incredible. It was actually an incredible mix of of surrealism is like fantastical, but also incredibly rooted in reality. It fused those together in this beautiful story of this young child. And if you haven't seen it, you have to go see it. It's just
it's gorgeous.
A stunning film. To me, I would have opted for that. Would have been my personal favorite. But that year, we saw the very star-studded Argo win out, and this is obviously Ben Affleck's movie, and George Clooney also helped produce it. This is like a real star vehicle. It was based on a true story of, I can't entirely remember, something to do with getting hostages out of Iran,
yeah,
right?
At the Canadian embassy.
That's it. So I was like, I kind of remember, I just remember
and it was good. I mean, it had like, it was like a solid thriller, yeah. International,
yes.
Sort of, you know, there were like some nice quiet moments in it because you follow this group of folks who are sort of hiding, essentially,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then you get the kind of action element of it and all the spy and the, yeah, White House drama, and it's a very good film. I mean,
yeah,
I think
it's really
solidly
well
holds up.
And also the cool thing about it was even though it was based on a true story and the stakes were super high, most people did not know this story.
Yeah,
so
true.
When you're watching it, you don't know where it's going, how it's
like
going
to
end.
You sort of know the big picture, especially because even if you know enough history of what happened with the, yeah, hostage crisis, the people who are like really the focus of it were not the headline story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this is, I think, you, Pia, you had talked a little bit when we were talking about this, and I know in your column, about what influence a studio release can have versus some of these other titles were either studio indies or were really more independent film. What role does that play here when you have Ben Affleck and you have, mm-hmm, a movie like Argo and you have a studio behind it? Is that in part how it ends up with the win?
Well, it all comes down to money, and a studio film has a lot more money behind it to campaign properly. This awards race is months long and very expensive. It's a lot of buying ads, throwing fancy events to invite people to come and schmooze with your stars. You have to fly from all over the world. This is not a cheap thing to do for any production company, and so studios really have the money behind them to be able to campaign properly. For a really small independent film, like something like Beasts of the Southern Wild, their hopes are in whichever studio buys it to distribute, there's going to be a sort of awards campaign element to that. So they are putting aside money for that, but it's very unlikely that the money is going to be on the same, yeah, level as the studio.
Yeah, I once talked to an independent director whose movie was nominated, and he was like, it killed us. Like, he was like, I almost wish it was never nominated, mm-hmm, because every amount of money that we had left over to do any, it was just, it all went into this campaign because we couldn't not campaign for it. But it was like, oh, we're not going to win. So, like, can we save this money for later to do, like, another movie? And it was just like,
it is like participating in a very expensive beauty pageant, if you can think about it. You have to get all the elements. Got to buy that tiara, buy, mm-hmm, all those dresses and the makeup and everything. This is a process.
And also, I will say, Argo, another sort of period piece, obviously, more recent period and more realistic, even though it has that sort of spy movie feeling to it. These other ones, the ones that are more escapist, like all of those they're kind of complicated escapism. Like,
yeah,
like Silver Linings Playbook is sort of the simplest emotionally of them. And even, mm-hmm, that is sort of asking the audience for a lot of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there is a way in which Argo was, compared to this list, the most straightforward.
Totally.
Because
even Lincoln, yeah, was like, I remember that was not the movie that anyone thought they were getting.
Right.
Like, that was a movie about politicking. It was not
actually
a biopic.
Yeah.
It was like how to win an election, it wasn't an election, but how to like win votes to pass legislation. That's what that movie was about.
Argo
and so
is almost
like
the,
what,
realistic one, but, yeah, the easiest.
Totally. And also, very, very.
Argo has the Hollywood element to it because they,
yeah,
obviously,
oh, good point,
that was a huge part of the plot, the
making a movie
to,
yeah,
help get these hostages out. So that, you know, we always keep going back to Hollywood loves Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
All
that
right.
is really inescapable. I mean, it sounds like an easy thing to say, but it's just so true every single time.
2014, Pia, what happened that year?
So 2014 was a year where we saw The Wolf of Wall Street, which is a Martin Scorsese film starring Leo DiCaprio, if you have not seen it yet. Mm-hmm. So we saw a big movie like The Wolf of Wall Street come up against movies like 12 Years a Slave, which is Steve McQueen's slavery tale. We also saw films like American Hustle, Dallas Buyers Club, Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity, big space like biopic, and then we saw Nebraska, which is a very sort of intimate family indie, and then we got like Her, which is a slightly, I mean, that is definitely a kind of escapist. You know, futuristic, yeah, world,
but also in that way where it's supposed to make you think about what realism is.
Totally. I mean, it shines a light on kind of our relationship with technology and sort of almost cast, you know, humankind's future forward a little bit. So yeah, we have lots of different things that we were contending with. Amazingly, this year in 2014, it was Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave that was the big winner. And I still remember that visual of that cast up on that stage, mm-hmm, and Steve just like jumping for joy. That was a huge win because this was a year where, you know, diversity very much came into play. People were looking at the fact that, you know, we had these great actors. And I think it was one of those years that I very much recall people actually starting to look at the makeup of racial representation in films and how it's very underrepresented. And so a movie like 12 Years a Slave, which also, by the way, had Brad Pitt as one of its producers, yep, and he stars in it as well. You know, it's a star-studded movie, but it really, I mean, it's a movie I really actually only watched once all the way through. It's incredibly difficult to get through. It's beautifully performed. And it's very sort of gritty period realism. It's the slavery tales that you didn't necessarily see. You know, it's a black filmmaker telling a story of his own ancestors and past. So I think you've got to look at the power of that, and that's what really shone through that year. While there were so many other great movies, that really, I think that was the deserved winner that
and
year.
And I think it was a year where voters actually thought very seriously about why they're making the choices that they make, mm-hmm, and who and what they should be rewarding. And I think you'll see after this year, there was a shift in the kinds of things, mm-hmm, that were winning. And I think ultimately the kinds of things that are getting made, hopefully. But
okay, let's jump in. 2015.
So this is where we start to see some interesting, this is where like the 10 nominee sort of, you know, thing, we've finally settled into that flow.
Less of a surprise.
Yeah. So we still aren't getting 10 nominees, but we got an interesting mix here. The standouts for me was, one was Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel. It was a movie that came out early in the year, and it's a very, you know, it's very typical Wes Anderson, quirky, fantastical period tale, and it just continued in its popularity throughout the year.
It was gonna say, it was so fantastical that it felt like an animated movie.
Yes,
like I was like, that's my favorite animated movie I've ever seen. I was saying that's one of the producers at the premiere. He's like, it wasn't animated, right?
But it felt like it could have been.
I'm sorry, that was an animated movie.
I take that as the compliment it is.
Like, you created a world that doesn't exist anywhere else, and you created it so specifically and so broadly. It was, I mean, that is the definition of escapist.
Whimsical, at its best, and it was just very beautifully orchestrated. And then we had a very gritty reality type film in American Sniper, Clint Eastwood's story with Bradley Cooper. We had The Imitation Game, a period drama starring Benedict Cumberbatch, on like the Bletchley Circle of spies. We have a movie like Selma, Ava DuVernay's movie, which had people like Oprah Winfrey involved. A very sort of strong historical American tale here, and we had a story like Whiplash, which was a Sundance indie directed by the little known Damien Chazelle back then, and that just, you know, grew and grew till it got to the Best Picture race. But that year, the talking point, the movie that I will say I was probably the most impressed by was Alejandro Iñárritu's Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, the full title. Birdman is, it's filmed to look like it's one shot. It's choreographed meticulously. It's beautiful performances from Michael Keaton, Ed Norton, Emma Stone, and again, I will also say this is a showbiz story, but it's set in New York's theater world. And once again, I think we saw Hollywood loves Hollywood.
Absolutely.
And they love a bit of, for me, I felt like if this was very much a Hollywood loves Hollywood, and this is such a wonderfully crafted feat of filmmaking, and it's an escapist fantasy. So
that said, I think I'm still mad that Selma didn't win.
I think this is it. When you've got these two types of movies up, it you've got Selma on one hand putting you in a very different mindset, and then Birdman on the other. And I think voters decided to go for the escapist route that time.
Bill.
Yeah, and I think again, like if we talk about Boyhood, it was like a remarkable.
I forgot about Boyhood. Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's all right. There's so many nominees anymore.
A lot, really, in that year.
But that's like
talk about feat of filmmaking.
Well, that's the thing. So it's a feat of filmmaking in a different way than Birdman. But that said, like, does that mean like it's a huge accomplishment and it's something that people hadn't done before? But does that mean like that is the best picture of the year? And I think people are kind of like, that was a really cool thing, but like what Birdman did was an experience when you're watching it in a way that Boyhood you don't have when we talked to, not to keep going back to my point, but like at the end of that movie you weren't like, whoa, like that kid became an adult, like, you know, it's not like
he didn't exactly, I
mean it's like a really interesting film, and but it ultimately you're not like, you don't walk out of the theater being, you know, invigorated by any sort of emotion.
And that, you are correct, though. That it did come down to Birdman versus Boyhood. That, I really think, were the final two. Both were incredible feats of filmmaking. Boyhood was 12 years in the making.
Yeah.
Like, 12 years of filming this one boy growing up. And, I mean, that is...
Totally.
That's an effort right there. But,
is it best picture or effort, or the ultimate finished product? And
like one of my favorite things about that movie, which probably hurt it from like not winning, was like there were so many opportunities for that kid's life to go terribly wrong. And it didn't, because that's not actually how life typically works. You know, like there's that scene where they're all in the house and they're like throwing those ninja stars.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God, someone's going to lose an eye. And
something
then no
bad's
one
gonna
and
happen.
No one does, because that's like, unfortunately, like kids miss like near death experiences all the time. And that's why the movie is kind of like quiet in a way and very real. But I think there isn't that moment where you're going to show that on the screen at the Oscars and be like, and like, I remember there's the stepdad who's drunk driving everybody home and you're like, oh my God, are they going to get, and they don't get an accident.
Yeah. It doesn't have enough dramatic realism.
And it's sort of like to the movie's credit, but like maybe not to its like Oscar reel.
It's like the mundane reality of life, which is what he captured so beautifully.
Yeah.
But that's mundane. It's not exciting. And I guess voters wanted exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay, 2016. Definitely had some excitement.
Yeah, the 2016, we saw some really interesting films. I thought, for me, like Mad Max Fury Road came out that year. And that was pretty, like, it was a movie that just... Everyone that I know who went to see it was blown away by it. You know, you think you're going in to see just this like kind of sequel to an action movie from like the 80s and you're like, eh, what's the big deal? And everyone was like, whoa. The entire film is essentially a car chase. You've got high stakes. You've got this insanely surreal post-apocalyptic world. So, talk about like fantastical escapism. That movie did that. And you also have a movie like the very surreal, real The Revenant.
Oh, my God. I tried to leave the theater like three times.
I don't even know how to like, I mean, that movie. So The Revenant is kind of inspired by true stories. And it's, you know, they try to ground it in reality. And the whole thing was that Leonardo DiCaprio, they threw him in the mud and, you know, made him gross, essentially, and made him sleep inside a horse. So.
Right.
You know,
I mean, both of those movies, I feel like I really enjoyed Mad Max. But I think to your earlier point about Black Swan, I never wanted to see that movie again.
Yeah.
Like, I was really glad
I did.
And I watched it at theater and I was like, it doesn't matter how many think pieces I read about this. I'm not going back to watch a single frame of it. And I feel like The Revenant, if people made it through, was similar. Not a repeat viewer.
Not something I've ever gone back to. But I still remember some scenes very vividly. It stays with you.
Yeah, my God. And that's like actors hazing themselves movies. Like, it's almost like they feel guilty about their lives. And like, you know, like and Leonardo DiCaprio is like, you know what? I need to work really hard on this one.
Well, it was essentially.
And really punish myself.
People kept saying that Leonardo DiCaprio is too pretty to win Best Actor. And he kept trying, kept like,
oh, I'll show you.
So he's like, just watch me. And funnily enough, and you've got to realize, like, sometimes this is what it takes. Sometimes it is like someone you see who is absolutely beautiful on screen and you know them to be like the Hollywood pretty boy or the, you know, the beautiful Hollywood darlings. When they go and they change up their appearance and they essentially, you know, for the want of a better word, uglify themselves, all of a sudden you see voters start to see them differently. And there is this joke that, you know, that is the route to go. If you haven't won an Oscar yet and you're looking for one, that is a route to go.
Definitely.
And Amy Adams. No, I'm kidding.
Oh my
but
God.
Didn't but work for Leo. So no. Instead we see.
In the year 2016, if you were talking to me, I was only talking about Spotlight.
Right.
Because you loved it.
I mean, I was out there. I was actually campaigning harder for that movie than the people who worked on it.
I watched that movie on a plane back to back with All the President's Men because it happened to be in the catalog. And I love All the President's Men. Spotlight is a better movie.
It is. Yeah. No,
for two movies that have exciting, riveting montages of door knocking and phone book research.
Right. Totally.
Which are not
that
things.
Genre. Is it a subgenre?
It's a sub-subgenre.
That is a sub-subgenre.
The index card genre, I would like to call that. But like, Spotlight is a great film.
It's fantastic.
Hands down. And I think to your earlier point, has a weight and an importance to it. I mean,
yes.
Here's a story that is still playing out
and
this year
and
continues to be a headline type story of, you know, documenting and investigating sex abuse in the church and also just in and of itself, a great movie.
It really was a great film. That star, that cast was incredible. It was unexpected as well. That one was like a real kind of, it came out of nowhere. And this was the thing that people kept going back to that movie after they had seen everything else. So you have all this big splashy fare, but it was this little studio indie with a very grounded real story that, like you said, still resonates today.
And tiny little action film about index cards.
Right.
But it's also the thing, it sort of got there's a lot of movies about abuses in the Catholic Church. Like, I mean, right before that, like Philomena, you know, before that, like people having, and this was like the movie that righted wrongs of other movies told you about. And it avenged all these things. And so everyone was like, yes, thank you. I needed this movie because I was so bummed out about all these other movies on this topic. And there's some justice here that was found. And I think when it first came out, we were talking about it in the office because a bunch of us went to see it. And someone was like, do you think that we like this because we're journalists? And I was like, no, that's not why you like this movie. You like this movie because, like,
justice is
the
being
little
done.
Guy took down like an institution that had been before then completely protected.
It's a David and Goliath story.
Totally.
And that was, again, it's just that hero's success story. This was hugely, like, the fact that it shone a light in the way that, you know, you're not always thinking, this is not something people are always thinking about. And like you said, films that have come along before it have sort of tapped into, like, a singular personal story. And it doesn't give you that sense of, like, discovering something and being able to start bringing down, you know, something that is this big. And in this case, this is like, you know, an entire religion and, you know, the Vatican here. So they took on this huge topic and that was the thing. This is a true story. And it resonated. And in that year, it was very satisfying as journalists or even not as journalists to see a really great, well-done journalism tale about something very real.
And a super, a great ensemble piece.
Mm-hmm. Like, really great
ensemble. Great cast with, you know, no one really had their big scene. Because I don't think anyone won acting prizes for Spotlight.
Didn't Michael Keaton?
No, I think everybody
won. Maybe one of the Globes.
I believe it was pretty much all ensemble. Like at SAG, it was ensemble. They were going in as ensembles. And I think that also really worked for them. Mm-hmm. That was a huge group effort.
Mm-hmm. All right, 2017. the most obvious of the showdown
now,
I feel like in
infamous 2017. Yeah. I think we can just jump straight to the obvious contender. It came down to La La Land versus Moonlight. That was, I remember that being sort of the final two. the week of the Oscars, and
all the way through to the end, and then the other end.
And goodness, and that was a roller coaster for I was in the press room, and we were like, you know, waiting for that winner to be announced, and then it got announced, and then everything, all hell broke loose.
Is it controversial if I ask you both which ones you were rooting for?
Not at all. I was rooting for Moonlight. You could.
I was rooting for Moonlight because I felt like it was the story that was more original to me. Having said that, though, I did really love La La Land. And I would have been, I remember like tweeting when La La Land was initially announced as winner. I was like, here's to the fools that dream, you know, thinking. And then everyone's like, yeah, fool, who dreamt? And I was like, no, but I really was incredibly happy. I just didn't know if a movie like Moonlight would win. Right. That was
so
a thing.
What's interesting, I've been thinking about this whole time we've been talking, yeah. is that, so Moonlight is the realism vote here, right? Obviously. Yes. But it really is in contrast to almost everything that Bill especially has been saying about it's yeah. not that, I mean, there is personal triumph in it, mm-hmm. but it is a very quiet movie about a very small number of people yeah. whose lives may have tragic and drama, sort of dramatic moments in it, mm-hmm. but it is not about the consequence that has on a world or a kingdom or sure. the lives of people. I mean,
yeah, no,
certainly their lives, but it is very specific.
Totally. I mean, the movie to win this year to like support that thesis of mine would have been Hidden Figures. I mean, it was the perfect example of that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it did win the SAG Award. And I think that one, quite frankly, was like about campaigning. I don't think the studio knew it was an Oscar movie. And then they jumped in the game too late. But you're right. I mean, Moonlight is the opposite of that.
Moonlight is, it's almost more like some of those years where we talk about where there were really good, quiet, hard, like difficult yeah. dramas about personal anguish and triumph. But but it was so relatable, I think, to so many people, even though it was really small. And I mean that in yeah. the best possible way.
No, I think that was it. It was the reason that I just didn't think it. I think Hidden Figures, actually, I remember thinking if anything really like kind of derails La La Land, it could be Hidden Figures. But Moonlight kind of had that last sort of, I remember in the last week it had a real push.
Yeah.
And I think that was really, I just didn't think a film that is so independent, so small and very originally done, like the pacing of that story, and also that this is really a movie of newcomers for the most part. I just didn't know if it had the weight to break through mm-hmm. with voters, whereas La La Land is this huge, splashy Hollywood story.
It should beat all of the. I think that's why that surprise on stage was the surprise. We were all like, wait, what? How is it possible that this little
exactly.
movie could actually
I remember
win?
Being devastated. I was like, how did that movie just beat Moonlight? It makes no sense to me. Because I think it was right after that shift that we were talking about earlier where yeah. voters were really thinking very seriously about what they were awarding and why. And that's like a feat of filmmaking. And it is interesting for all those reasons to a viewer where you're like, this isn't a star-studded cast. And the narrative, like the structure isn't exactly what I was expecting. And
there was that phase where you started to see a little bit of that La La Land backlash where it was
totally.
It was too enjoyable, too escapist, well, too like, you know, and then there was the whole sort of response to that I think may or may not have ended up helping Moonlight have a little bit of that edge.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, Moonlight, though, I think its specificity, it was so commendable, too. So it's like, there's nothing, I mean, there are very few things about that movie that a lot of people can relate to, except there are, because when you go that specific, you're just dealing with a tale of, like, humanity
Universal.
On many levels.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a huge fan of musicals, which is kind of why I didn't like La La Land, because I was like, this is not a huge, like the
not
dance.
Not big enough.
No, not big enough for me. I'm yeah. like, if you're doing this, do it. Like, go all in.
Sing everything.
And yeah.
Moulin
and just, like,
Rouge
and,
all
like,
the way.
Like, where's the choreography here? Like, that opening sequence when everyone was talking about how great it was. I'm like, have none of you been to a musical? Like, and I know that's what they were going for. Like, but I was like, no, I don't want like this version of a musical.
I really enjoyed it. I did not think it was the best musical I had ever seen.
Yeah.
And I think in that same way,
I was
like, whereas like Moonlight, I was like, I felt like I could barely even create a sentence about that film and how I felt about it for like weeks.
Right.
Yeah, it was, I think it really stuck with people. Plus, Moonlight also had Brad Pitt as an executive producer. Yeah. So once again, you know, that little, it could that have just been support. A little bit of that star mm-hmm. support that really helped mm-hmm. edge it.
Plus, and he went out, he introduced it in places. Did. Like, yeah. He was at, I think, the first screening I was at.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Remember when Janelle Monáe comes on the screen and she just like is like lights the whole thing up. It was amazing. I remember thinking that like I just that was the first. I mean, she'd been a musician, but like, oh my God. In that movie, she is luminous.
She was wonderful in that. And then to like also kind of see her in Hidden Figures as well. Yeah. That same just, year.
It's not
she had a real moment.
She's so good at so she's many incredible. Things. It's just really. Yeah. OK, let's talk about 2018 real quickly to get us through that. You know what? Where did we end up there?
So yeah, this year, which it sort of came down to, there are a few movies that sort of stood out towards the end of the race. One was Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird, which people just absolutely loved because you had this incredibly visionary female filmmaker telling a very, very real story of a teenager. And it was wonderful. And like, especially a lot of women, like myself included, really, really found ourselves
and
drawn
so
to
real.
It.
Very, like, so, almost too real in that, like,
very real. Very, very like, real.
To not be that age again.
In a way that we hadn't really seen the mother-daughter relationship portrayed before. And then we had Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri, which is, it's a sort of very grounded in reality story of a woman who's trying to avenge the abduction and murder of her daughter in a small town. And, you know, this is Frances McDormand playing this character that she did win Best Actress for. And this character is so unlikable on the surface. You know, she's this incredibly angry, foul-mouthed mother who just does not take any nonsense and, you know, But in that, she might be unlikable by traditional senses, but she also came along at a time where, like, she resonated. We needed women to be rising up and fighting a system. And I think that's what that movie delivered. We also had Jordan Peele's Get Out, which is this incredible horror movie that really actually touched on so many social and political and racial elements, really racial elements. It was a movie that broke out of the horror genre. It shifted the conversation around horror. It entered the best picture race and became a real strong contender and really shone a spotlight on what horror can do. This is something we were talking about last week with Jamie Lee Curtis's story as well. But, you know, this movie showed horror can give a very timely tale, even if it's wrapped into this kind of slightly surreal context, obviously, and really resonate deeply. So that's a movie that did both. Funnily enough, though, it was Guillermo del Toro's fantastical surreal The Shape of Water, which I know so many people describe it as, I guess it's the merman human romance.
Oh, that is the love that story? Is the cleanest version of that I've heard.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Sure. So let's go with that.
This is Guillermo del Toro's. You know, he has an incredible vision and imagination. He crafted a very surreal, fantastical escapist story, I would say, and that was the movie that won out on the night, which was very interesting, especially when you hold it up to very real tales, very timely real tales, and things like Get Out and Three Billboards.
I feel like Guillermo del Toro is like the smartest, most brilliant, most creative 12-year-old ever. You know what I mean? And the most, that's what his, that's why his movie, that's why his movies are so marvelous, because it's just like, there's such like expansiveness without any sort of like, yeah, I don't even know what word I would use to describe what happened to me between the ages of 12 and 42, but you know what I mean? There's like no cynicism, and there's just like all the possibilities in the world, and believing in love, and believing in hard, and believing in, even when you watch like Crimson Tide, it's or Crimson Peak, rather.
Yeah.
It's like, he's just, his heart is all out there.
I think he really, he's such a fascinating filmmaker as well. He really always loves, he's drawn to exploring these very pure fantastical tales. He loves a story. There's always a lot of innocence in his stories, and he loves sort of showing the journey of that. You can go back to like Pan's Labyrinth even and see that. So yeah, his vision is incredibly unique and incredibly
intriguing. Do you think that film
intriguing.
Won because of the, just very specific, because that film was great, or because it was the escapist option, the best of the escapist options in a year that people were really looking for that.
I think for me, the movie last year that dominated conversation was Get Out. For me, yeah. Get Out was a film that should have won because it changed the game and it delivered a story that was so well done. And
I think it was a little ahead of its time. I think it came up against
like maybe voters didn't want to go so political. And that was the thing. Get Out and Three Billboards were very political films. And then even a movie like Lady Bird became politicized within the awards race because it was like female directors are never acknowledged and, you know, they need acknowledgement. And that kept bringing. And I don't think voters ever like to be preached to about what they should be doing. They want to come to it.
And Get Out was the most challenging of those politically.
It was.
Right.
Definitely.
It was really the one that you, if you are a white voter of the Academy,
yes.
have to acknowledge all different kinds of racism that you've been complicit in.
Absolutely.
And then go vote for that for Best Picture, which is maybe asking, unfortunately, too much of many of those voters.
Well, why not then vote for a Mexican filmmaker in a story of a merman / human romance?
Well, okay. I remember I was talking to someone. So the Three Billboards and Shape of Water came from the same studio. So it was, and I was talking to someone there, and they were like, it would be an achievement on like our side of campaigning to get Three Billboards to win because you have to sell people on that. That's a tough pill to swallow, that movie. Versus The Shape of Water is the easier one for us to sell on Best Picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which they, I mean, they did really
and
well
because
Three Billboards got two acting awards mm-hmm. that night, Sam Rockwell and Best Supporting Actor and Frances McDormand and Best Actress. So they, I mean, in a way, they got the accolades that they wanted to get. And then Shape of Water ended up being the, perhaps the safer choice to go with.
Who would have thought that would be the safer choice?
Right. And I think, like, back to Get Out, I just don't think the studio itself knew they had an Oscar movie on their hands because they didn't know what they had on their hands because that movie is unlike anything else. So they're like, wait, is this an Oscar thing? They knew it was going to, like, win big at the Indie Spirits, but, like, were they supposed to start campaigning hard for this as an Oscar movie? And I think they joined the campaign really late on that.
They did.
I'm so ready for people to stop being so surprised when they make great movies that people love them and want them to win things. Please give people credit. Yeah.
I think this is so funny because the movie came out, like, I think in February of the year. And this is the thing with horror movies. Any studio with a horror movie doesn't necessarily think that this, they've got a contender in their hands, even if it's an incredible horror movie. It's a horror movie. These movies don't get that out in February. Yeah.
That's why, and then,
they never thought it was going to go the trajectory that it ended up going on. I don't think they ever planned for that.
No, and it's like someone at Thanksgiving was like, hey, guys, should we maybe do a campaign for this? And it's like, everyone's been playing their campaigns for quite some time now. Let's just throw it in.
Get on board. All right. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about this year's contenders in this escapist versus realism category. And then we are going to make some bold predictions. I feel like we're getting bolder by the minute here with what we're ready to say. Which movies people need to be campaigning for now. And we will be right back.
Today's podcast is brought to you by the Amazon Prime original series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, winner of 8 Emmy Awards, including Outstanding Comedy Series. Starring Emmy and Golden Globe winner Rachel Brosnahan as Midge Maisel, a 1950s housewife who finds her voice as a stand-up comedian in New York City. From Paris to the basement of B. Altman, from the Catskills to a nightclub in D.C., Midge's choice to pursue stand-up is more challenging and fraught than ever. From writer-executive producers Amy Sherman-Palladino and Daniel Palladino, and also starring Emmy winner Alex Borstein, Michael Ziegen, Maren Hinkle, and Tony Shalhoub, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel returns for a new season on December 5th on Amazon Prime Video.
Welcome back to The Awardist. I'm Shayna Naomi Crockmull. I'm here with Pia Sena Roy and Bill Keith, all from EW. And we are talking about the big picture look at the best picture race and whether escapism or realism is more likely to net you a statue at the end of the night. We've gone through all of the years that you were allowed to have more than just a handful of best picture nominees. And I think the overall winner, historically speaking, in escapism versus realism is, Pia, the award, realism, right? Usually, with some notable exceptions, right? Yes. The Artist, Birdman, Shape of Water, some escapist, but also very specifically great films. Mm-hmm. certainly all of these films are winning on the merits, but generally speaking, what we have discovered in this look back is that realism, especially realism with high stakes, generally speaking, is a good bet when it comes to Best Picture. So let's talk about this year's films for the 2019 Oscars. We survived last week's midterm elections, more or less. And if there is a clear trend we've seen emerge overall through new films that we're going to be talking about, a lot of serious filmmakers are making pretty serious films, right? Mm-hmm. So let's break those down a little bit more. Pia, talk to me about the stories that in films we've seen so far. Also, rough estimate, how many new movies, Bill, Pia, have you seen so far already for this batch of contenders?
I can't even tell
in the dozens
you.
Or in the hundreds? Dozens, right?
Definitely dozens. In the dozens. Okay. I don't know if it's in the hundreds yet.
I'm excited to have you both here because I feel like between you, your knowledge is so comprehensive.
We spend a lot of time in dark rooms.
With just a handful of other people.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about the ones that are really overtly about politics or social justice.
I think you have movies like, we had Spike Lee's BlacKkKlansman, which I think is, it's incredible. It's actually a true story of Colorado Springs' first black police officer who infiltrated the KKK, the local chapter of the KKK. It's an insane story, and it's real. This happened. And you can see how very, it's Spike Lee, so you know that there's very strong parallels drawn, that he draws directly into present-day America and the social and racial fractures in our nation today.
But it is that thing, like Argo, right? Where it's like, this is a, what? This is a true story?
True, but unheard.
What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Let alone the way he delivers the story, which is completely unexpected. Like, if you hadn't talked to anyone about BlacKkKlansman and you just read, like, what it said on Fandango, and then you saw the movie, the presentation of it is completely unexpected.
It is. And I think the fact that it might not have been reality. It could have just been fiction and still be as powerful. But I think the fact that it's a real story just really grounds it in that reality element. And then you have Barry Jenkins has returned this year after Moonlight with If Beale Street Could Talk. He's adapted James Baldwin's novel for this. And again, I mean, this is a very, even though James Baldwin's novel was about 50 years ago or so, Barry Jenkins, you know, again, draws a sort of very subtle, timely comparison in the story of a young black couple who find themselves, you know, persecuted against because of their race. And it's devastating. And it's something that I think a lot of people can see, you know, very real parallels in the conversations and things happening in this year. And then we have a movie like Hate, The Hate U Give. It's adapted from a young adult story, but this movie is fiction, but it might as well just be real. This is any unarmed black man or woman who has been killed in police shootings over the course of the last few years. You know, these things that led to the rise of Black Lives Matter. This incredibly powerful film. Like, I have only seen it once all the way through. I don't know if I can go back and watch it again, but it's a fictional story, but it's incredibly grounded in reality. It's the, you know, it shows what it would mean to, like, you know, stand up for a cause, the cost of standing up for a cause. It's centered on a young, a 16-year-old girl played by Amanda Stenberg, who's fantastic, and whether she should speak up for her dead friend or not. And that in itself is just huge. The stakes are so high. This is something that is, all the scenes from it are pretty much ripped from headlines.
And I think if you're someone who maybe only read about Ferguson or about other situations like that and didn't experience any of that firsthand or didn't know anyone who did, it really puts you in that point of view in a way that makes it feel very necessary to understand better. Like you want to understand it better if you haven't.
I agree. I think it really delves into understanding the racial differences and the way that even like it's phrases like casual racism and how they are part of society, and you may not realize it. And that's what this movie does so beautifully. And it also has many layers. You know, the lead character's uncle is a police officer. And so you get to see all these different perspectives to...
it's approachable in that very Oscar-y way.
It is.
Yeah, yep. Well, because I think largely because of who the narrator is. It's all from the point of view. It comes from a YA book that's all told from the point of view of the how old is she?
She's 16.
Yeah. Year old. And that lends it a more approachable angle to this topic because it feels really intimate.
And then there is a movie coming up that we're all very interested to see, which is Adam McKay's Vice. This is the Dick Cheney story starring Christian Bale. Mm-hmm. Super intrigued by this. It's obviously incredibly real and you know, based on real life politics and political figures. So
and also has that same Revenant quality of the leading man who wants to
punish himself.
Yeah, Christian Bale is unrecognizable. Like, literally did not recognize him at all, and had to very much do double takes to realize.
Yeah, it'll be interesting though, because this falls under the category of, like, this is a totally fascinating story that everyone's interested in hearing, but you are not going to walk out of this movie being like, yes,
yeah.
Yeah, like,
no.
Victory.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
So there's also, Pia, you've kind of looked at these other films that are much more going to inspire that kind of moment, right? even when they're sad or tragic, these great stories about the human condition, kind of broad character journey. So take us quickly through a couple of those.
Sure. Well, the most obvious one here is A Star Is Born. You know, we see this, you know, kind of star-crossed lovers story here, and it's Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. It's obviously done huge numbers at the box office, and it very much is, you know, dealing with your demons and overcoming obstacles, and really just it's a very human journey here. So,
and at a time when I feel like people are still struggling with but interested in talking about addiction.
Absolutely. Yeah, addiction is like, I think there's been a real spotlight on addiction. I think that's also seen in a film like Beautiful Boy with Steve Carell and Timothée Chalamet as a father and son, as a father who's having to deal with his son's opioid addiction. And then there's a story like Men's Bag. It's a very similar story of Julia Roberts as a mother dealing with her son's recovery from opioid addiction. So there's a huge spotlight on addiction and really the journey, not just as an individual, but as families and as your loved ones to try and overcome that. You see that in all of these films. And these are very human stories. They're very difficult to watch at times, but
same with Boy Erased, even though it's not so much about addiction, but in a similar family story.
Yeah, Boy Erased is about the true story of a young man who was sent to gay conversion therapy camp by his very religious parents. Stars Russell Crowe and Nicole Kidman as parents, Lucas Hedges, and it's directed by Joel Edgerton. It's a really, really beautiful film. Very timely, because this is something that I don't think many people are aware of. is still happening. Gay conversion therapy is still happening. It's incredibly flawed thing that goes on, and it really does put lives of LGBTQ kids at risk. So this is a movie that's incredibly, I would say, from that element, this isn't just a human journey, but this is a movie that does both, where it's tapping into, you know, social justice issue as well.
Mm-hmm. And we have a bunch of historical.
Wait, but you guys didn't talk about the movie I'm always going to talk about. Sorry. Green Book.
Great. Well, that's why I was queuing it up for sort of historical realism.
See?
Yeah.
So, Bill, you should tell Green Book.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Green Book. look, Green Book is a lot about, it's hitting on a lot of things we're talking about. And I didn't even do that on purpose. I wasn't building to this moment. But no, Green Book is, again, based on a true story that not many people are aware of. And it's a true story that speaks to a larger story about progress in this country, or lack of progress. And it spurs a lot of thought on that. The performances are incredible. It's a little unexpected too, because it's actually a pretty funny movie. It comes from the director of Dumb and Dumber, which is insane. And I say that with all sorts of love for Dumb and Dumber. And sincerely, I love that movie.
But not something you'd normally be talking about in an Oscars podcast.
Well, no. I mean, the director, Peter Farrelly, even said at Toronto, when they were presenting Green Book, he was like, huh, I've never been to a film festival before. Like, let alone being in an Oscar conversation. So, but it's a pretty remarkable story, and it also has a feeling of hope and
not necessarily triumph at the end of it, but certainly hope. And it's a journey that you see to these two characters go on that are very representative of more than just themselves. And I hope people really, really, I think people are going to really get into this movie.
I think so too. It's not a movie that has quite gotten out there yet, but it's definitely a film that I think will resonate. I think we also have, movies like First Man, which is very much, it's a biopic of Neil Armstrong, and it's him shouldering the burden of being the first man on the moon versus his own personal struggles of being a husband and a father and, you know, a man who's lost a child. So that was
incredible. Does hit like all of those kind of notes we've been talking about in that the stakes are high, the emotion is high, it's real, but it's a slightly different angle on a story you've heard.
It's weird though, it obviously didn't catch on at the box office. And I feel like I would say the only thing Hollywood might like more than itself is space. And I feel like people were like, oh my God, they're putting another famous person in space. Mm. Like, and I don't think there was an effective communication of what this movie is to the general public.
Yeah.
And so people are kind of like, I don't need to see Gosling in space. I just saw Sand. I just saw Ant. Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually really different. It's not Apollo 13.
No,
it's,
but everyone, that message did not get across.
Mm-hmm. I think also, it didn't do very well at the box office, surprisingly, actually. But I think they're hitting the campaign trail hard. Yeah. You know, the stars Ryan Gosling and Claire Foy, and Damien Chazelle is someone that, you know, a lot of people are very interested in him after Whiplash and La La Land. And they're going out and campaigning hard. You know, they're doing these big splashy events.
I think because
for voters,
because of the disappointing box office.
Exactly. They have to try and get attention. But they do.
So here's one where maybe your theory about the Globes might give it enough of a boost to kind of get it back out there. Yeah. People watching it, see more people seeing
it. I think this is one where the fact that it has Universal Pictures as a studio behind it is, this is where you'll see that studio money coming into play. You're going to see big splashy events. You're going to see big Q&As and celebrity meet and greets. And, you know, Ryan Gosling, people love him. People love Claire Foy.
It'll be interesting because Universal, when you bring that up, and love our friends at Universal, that's not a studio who's used to campaigning for movies.
No.
That's the studio that didn't know what to do with Get Out.
Yes, that's correct. And they also have Green Book this year.
And they have Green Book this year, yeah. So it's it'll be interesting to see how they navigate this, because they obviously are a hugely successful studio, but not in this arena.
So along those lines, Roma.
Yes, the movie that I was hopefully coming to was Roma. This is Alfonso Cuarón's movie about, it's a black and white film. It's a period piece set in like 1971 Mexico City. And it is based on his memories of his own childhood caretaker, like a live-in maid, who he said was basically the woman who raised him. He wanted to craft, an homage to her and tells this really beautiful story of this woman who works for this family, focusing on her trials really over the course of a year, I would say. And she lives such a simple life, and you just see her go through these incredible roller coaster moments. And it talk about a character journey. You're taking someone who is so, he keeps saying he wanted to shine a spotlight on these invisible women. And I think that's exactly what he does. He showcases the life of a woman who represents so many women overlooked, and does it so beautifully. And by the end, like, not giving anything away, but, you know, by the end, you really do feel like this is someone who, it makes you realize you should pay more attention to the people in your lives, the people who so often go overlooked. And I just thought it's incredibly beautiful. It's going to be released on Netflix, but they are doing a theatrical release in limited theaters before that. So it is a movie that I recommend seeing on the big screen. But obviously,
yeah, me too.
You can also catch it over Christmas at home and watch. And I feel like you'll feel the same way. But for me, big screen was a huge part.
Yeah, if you want to watch this movie, you definitely should be watching it on the big screen.
I agree. It's beautiful, and it really captures everything. This is a story that when you're looking at escapism versus realism, right? This is a story that's obviously very grounded in, like, there's a real story here, but it's actually very dreamy because it's a sort of nostalgic tale that's based on memories. And so it's crafted in a very dreamy way. And the black and white of it all places it in another time. So there is like an escape factor to it. You're escaping into the life of another family and another home.
Immersive.
It's very immersive. I think that's...
It is very beautifully shot.
It is. It's beautiful. So this is something that I think, you know, gets us into movies that might be sort of doing a little bit of both.
Yeah, let's talk about those. We have a couple who you think are trying to both kind of get that political beat, but also broadly talk about the characters or a human condition.
So for me, you know, we had a movie like On the Basis of Sex, which is the not biopic, but tale of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The director does not want it to be a biopic, but I think it feels biopic in
not
some
in a
ways.
Bad way.
Like, yeah, it's the origin. It's kind of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's origin story. It's the first big case that she took on. I'd love to know what you two think about this one, because I felt like this is something that is a human journey, but obviously hugely political resonance and timely resonance. Mm-hmm. But yeah, what did you sort of think on the resonance of that?
I mean, I think it is definitely the kind of film that I would take a niece to or my mom to. And I mean that as a compliment. I mean, I think it has that sort of Hidden Figures inspirational element to it, where you watch it. It's not distant history, but it is timely, certainly. And thinking about, you know, the stakes of the Supreme Court, I almost wish this movie had come out last year, because I feel like that helps. It really helps craft a really specific argument as to how much one person can and where they come from and how they develop their thinking and their approach to law.
An understanding of what the purpose of that body is and what the purpose of law is. And I think if you didn't know, if we didn't know where this person's story was ultimately going, and that is obviously to become a Supreme Court justice, the story on its own is not a riveting tale.
Correct.
I think the whole time you're watching it, you're definitely benefiting from being like, God,
I know where
we
this
love
ends.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, it's phenomenal that she's able to be where she is today. So you're watching the sort of early obstacles, but there's not like the movie doesn't actually get like it's one case and it's not a sexy case, to say the least. It's a tax case. It's about tax law. And ultimately, like, the ripple effects of what she sets up there are incredible, and it overturns like 150 laws or sets the stage for that. But you're really watching, like, you're really watching tax law unfold for at least an hour. Mm-hmm. And so it's just sort of like, you know she's going to become a Supreme Court justice someday, but you don't even get halfway there. You just barely get to like the beginning. So from that point of view, it's not like a riveting, like fist in the air at the end of that movie. I mean, there is a part of the end of that movie that makes you cry a lot.
Yeah,
with excitement. But I would say it's a kind of a lovely but like quiet movie.
I think that's fair. Yeah, I sort of felt the same, which I guess then takes us into a movie that certainly isn't quiet. Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Marvel superhero story.
I love that we get to now talk about Black Panther and Best Picture. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
finally Black Panther gets into this discussion. I'm really excited to see what Black Panther does. This came out in February, so this has been a long way here, but this is still to date, I believe, this biggest movie at the American box office this year. And it's a story that is set in Marvel's fantastical superhero world. We see the world of Black Panther is in Wakanda, which is this beautiful, obviously fictional, although I kind of hope maybe it might be real, world, you know, that is hidden away. We're seeing, you know, the superhero world in all this glory in this movie. And then you have this incredibly grounded tale of really what it means to be black in America today, with the villain I put in quotes because he's probably one of the most sympathetic villains I've ever come across, Michael B. Jordan's Eric Killmonger. He's someone who brings up the discussions of what it means to be African-American versus what it means to be African. He, when he comes face-to-face with Chadwick Boseman's T'Challa, the conversations they have, the discussions they have, the kind of clashes and tensions they have are things that, again, these are things that I don't think people, if you're not part of the Black community or know it well, you may not think of these things existing, but they exist. And to have them, that conversation on a stage that is the Marvel superhero world is insane to me. And the fact that it had, it showed Black excellence and shone a real spotlight on Black excellence on screen this year in a way, and at a time where we really needed to see it in movies for so long. You know, a lot of people say the only way that you see people of color really being recognized in films is they tend to be historical tales, and quite often slavery tales. Full of pain, tragedy, and it's just like, why do we always have to see that? This is a movie that did not do that. You know, obviously there are those elements of pain and tragedy, but it's Marvel superheroes, and it's
What do we think in terms of its Oscar chances?
I think it's a Best Picture nomination worthy movie. I think that's been in the conversation from the beginning, and people are really championing it. So that is whether it will.
Well, I think to successfully do both of those like major things that you're talking about there, to like hit on the superhero of it all and to successfully tell those stories that you're talking about in a way that other movies haven't, like that alone puts it in Best Picture contention. And I think that's the most likely, besides costumes, I think the definitely most likely area for this to get nominated.
I think so, yeah.
I can't see like any of the performances necessarily getting a nomination.
I think, and that's not Michael to say that, B. Jordan maybe, and I would say off the sort of strength of Creed 2 that's coming up, and there's been a lot of love for him, plus he's getting a lot of covers, so you know, there's it's just an awareness that he may, because supporting race is hasn't quite really fleshed out yet, so it's a possibility, but you're right that I think like the Best Picture is really kind of
and as much as like I love Danai Gurira in this movie, she's incredible. She's kind of my favorite thing in the whole movie, favorite performance, sort of, but it's not like it's not an Oscar performance. Like, there's no clip to roll during the ceremony of her in this movie, but she's phenomenal.
Is the film itself too escapist, given the trends we just went through? Do we think that's going to be its challenge? That sort of like that weird ding of like being too popular. Plus,
it's a weird year.
It's a very weird year.
This could be the wild card.
I think the fact that it is so popular goes against it. The fact that this is a massive studio film goes against it, because we know that like Oscar voters tend to like the more serious, dramatic fare, and quite often the smaller budget fare, because, you know, it sort of gives this impression that the less money you have, the more creative you have to be.
Film,
if you're given all the money in the world, then, you know, you have all the resources. But I think this movie, listen, if this gets into the Best Picture race, this is the first time in a very long time that a movie of this genre and of this kind of stature is getting into that race. So that itself could be a win. I don't know.
Totally. It's interesting, too, because you think about it. Like, so this movie made $700 million. And it was like, I'm trying to think, like American Sniper for its year made like, it was the top grossing movie of its year, and it was like $600 million or $500 million. And it was up for Best Picture, I think, but it didn't win.
It was up for Best Picture, correct, yeah.
I don't know. It'd be interesting to look back and see, like, top grossing movies that also happen to be the Best Picture winner. I don't think it happens that often, but it's kind of
it's
amazing when it does.
It's very rare that a Best Picture winner crosses the 100. I was looking into this for the Popular Film Oscars category that they had sort of announced initially and then scrapped. But it's very rare that a Best Picture winner has crossed the 100 million mark at the box office. I think Argo was actually the last time in like 10 years that that's happened. So, and I'm talking about the winners, obviously. Sure. American Sniper did make about 500 million at the global box office. But I think, you know,
speaking of Creed, like that was one of the rare ones where Rocky, the year it came out in 76, won Best Picture and was also the highest grossing movie.
Yeah.
There's just
It's weird. Like, I don't feel like voters like to necessarily reward those big
movies.
even though a lot of them work on them, and these are the movies that make money. These are the movies that allow them to then go on and make their other films. So
And we're talking about actual people who are voting. I think that's always the kind of caveat when we talk about the Academy, is it's not a monolith. Mm-hmm. There is no single Academy voting on something. We've got about 9,000 people, and even more diverse now than, you know, certainly not necessarily reflective of the community in Hollywood or America as a large, but getting closer with almost 1,000 new members were added. So I think we're going to see where that ends up. Popular, real, escapist, all coming together. Any last thoughts on this big picture, best picture?
No, I just feel like it's always a fun thing to look at when you're looking at escapism versus realism, because it really does sort of shine a light on where we are in that moment. And you can... So I'm just intrigued to see what 2018 is going to reflect for years to come in that Best Picture race.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a minute and do a few quick, bold takes. We're prognosticating far in advance, relatively speaking. It'll be here before we know it. So I'm going to ask for a couple of bold takes and predictions. Last week, our TV critic Kristen Baldwin told us why passionately she believes that Cody Fearn deserves a Golden Globe nomination. So give me, since what we're looking up next is the Golden Globe nominations, which will come out December 6th, if you were going to, in hopes of either just honoring someone at the Golden Globes or setting them up for Oscar success, make a quick pitch to the Hollywood Foreign Press Association about who should get nominated. Because you love it so much, because you feel like it needs that extra jump. Bill, I'm going to start with you.
Oh. Hmm. I mean, I could just continue my lobbying for Green Book and be like,
just
give it
that
to Linda Cardellini. For a role that should have been a throwaway role but wasn't in Green Book. But I'm not actually saying she should get a nomination. But I was surprised by that role. Sorry. Are we talking Globes, you said?
Yeah, Globes, since it's up next. So
for her, like, 7 minutes of screen time, let's bring Cher in for Mamma Mia 2.
That is a bold prediction.
That
I
is
like
real
it.
Bold.
I like
mean,
it.
But do you actually think that would be that surprising if the HFPA decided to throw Cher a bone for Mamma Mia 2?
No.
She's definitely the highlight of that film.
Listen, if this means we get to hang out with Cher at the post-Globes parties, I'm in.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, Pia, what's your pitch?
My pitch is, it's a performance pitch, and it's Emily Blunt. Which I think is perhaps a bit more obvious rather than being a bold take. But having just seen Mary Poppins and obviously having seen Quiet Place earlier this year, and just realized this woman is incredible. She's such a talented actress. She has not been nominated for Oscars before, which is insane to me. But Mary Poppins, by the way, I don't know how much I can really say too much about it, but like it is such a beautiful, beautiful film, and it all hinges on her performance here. That is such an iconic role. So to be able to take that on, spin your own twist on it, and do such a beautiful job on it, Emily Blunt nailed it. And she's incredible. Like, she's such a smart, like, woman as well, who is just so savvy in her choices. I love that we've seen her flip between different genres, different types of characters, different performances. And a lot of people keep sort of drawing the comparison of she's kind of like the Meryl Streep of our generation. I think, you know, she's only in her 30s, but she's definitely shown that she can take on anything thrown her way and deliver incredibly.
And I think what's even cooler, and I think Meryl Streep would say this, no, she gets to be much more than me.
Yeah.
Because, like, the roles that she's getting to do weren't available to Meryl Streep when Meryl Streep was, you know, in her 30s, let alone, like, the years coming. I mean, there's literally nothing that Emily Blunt can't do. Like, she is mind-blowing. It's just so great.
Absolutely.
Shameless plug, go to EW.com for our Mary Poppins cover story, including interview with Meryl.
It's a beautiful cover, and it's a beautiful story. You have to go read it.
My quick pitch to the HFPA would be Amanda Stenberg to nominate her.
That would be great.
Because I just think her performance is so, in Hate U Give, is so rich and so, I think you, Pia, you and Kristen convinced me last week that they are a good place to find an emerging star and to really shine a spotlight on them. And I would like Amandla to be a household name. I think she, not just among 16-year-olds, but among everyone. So that would be, she would be my
pick. A good bit.
I feel
like
we've been saying for like 10 years since she was like four that she's a breakout. But like this is legitimately a breakout role.
God, she's so,
so it's like
good.
To where you're like, I mean, I remember going into that movie and like, oh, great, she's great. But like then you see the film and you're like, no, no, no.
What's happening?
Fantastically talented.
Yeah.
And this is a huge, huge story that you just told here. Yes. And it would have completely fallen apart if this person
had not been.
Right. Yeah. All right. Next question. You have seen so many films already. Mm-hmm. We have a great full contender list that Pia has been updating on EW.com. Got a lot of movies on it, and we keep updating it. What is one film you haven't seen yet that you think we will end up talking about and will be in serious contention?
Vice.
Okay.
The Adam McKay movie about Dick Cheney.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to see it.
Bill?
I'm really excited to see Creed 2. I haven't, you know, the Creed, I think, was wonderfully unexpected. Like, I remember going into that screening and being like, oh, I hope this is cool. And then you walk out and you're like, that was awesome.
Yeah. I've seen Creed 2. It's, I'm still really thinking about it more than I almost kind of thought I would be.
Oh, so, good. Because I don't even know if I say that from like a awardist perspective, but just sort of like film going, like, I can't wait to
you'll
see that movie.
You'll enjoy it. You guys have convinced me. I haven't seen Roma. That has been my. I just haven't quite gotten there yet. But
it.
I will.
Yeah.
I will go do that. Okay. And then one film that you, in your capacity of covering film, you've seen many things before other people have. Some things that are not even out yet or not out widely. What's one that you're really excited for movie fans to see?
Bill, you want to go first?
I'll put on my international cinema hat and say that, and this is sort of an Oscar pool tiebreaker for you too, I loved Cold War, which is like actually the Star is Born that I wanted. That. You're not going to hear me on here talking about how I think A Star is Born is a phenomenal movie. Cold War is, I think it'll be up for Best Picture from Poland. It's from the director who did Ida. It's also black and white. It's beautifully shot. It's so much more sweeping than actually A Star is Born. But it's a very similar story. It's basically the Polish A Star is Born. So it's this woman who is a performer, and she partners with the guy who's running. He's like her accompanist. And anyway, it's told over like 30 years. And it's so beautiful and nuts. And I hope people are going to be – I don't know how widely it's going to get distributed – but I think come Oscar time, it'll definitely be nominated.
Team Poland.
I'm all over it.
I'll go next because I want Pia to get to have the last word. Okay. Mine, I realized yesterday that people have not seen If Beale Street Could Talk.
Right.
And I actually got like really emotional just thinking about it. I saw that at Toronto. I was at the premiere. I literally just sat in the balcony and wept. I think it is so beautiful. I think Barry Jenkins, you can see him and his stamp like all over it. But at the same time, it's such a different, warm story full of like joy and love and fear. And it occurred to me that people haven't seen it yet, and I have not talked about it nearly enough. I'm excited for that to be there. Put it on your list. Strongly recommend. Pia, what is your one film you just really can't wait for people to get a chance to see themselves?
So for me, it's got to be, my favorite is The Favourite. Yorgos Lanthimos's really insane story of Queen Anne's court. It's Olivia Colman as Queen Anne, Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone as the handmaidens vying for her attention and her confidence. And it's insane. It's also brilliant. It's such an incredibly detailed dissection and insight into the minds of these three women, and it's a tale of manipulation, and it has such excellent moments of drama and absolutely hilarious moments of comedy.
My God,
like
so much
those
comedy.
Comedic moments are incredible. And my favorite thing here is just, if you don't know Olivia Colman, if you haven't had a chance to see her in the incredible series Broadchurch, or all these incredible things that she's been doing in England for so long, this is a movie I would love for you guys to discover her on. She's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And Rachel Weisz, like you've never seen her.
It's true. She's actually incredible too. And Emma Stone as well.
And Emma Stone's good. Nicholas Holt is great in it.
I haven't seen this one yet, so I've been trying to get to it. So it's on my list too.
Bonkers. So good. It's bananas. Okay, bananas. On that note, this has been this episode of The Awardist. Thanks for listening to us. We went deep and kept going, and thanks for sticking around with us. You've got complete coverage of awards season from Golden Globes to Oscars and everything in between at EW.com and in the magazine. We've also, EW has partnered with the AFI Fest, which is going on right now in Hollywood, and so we're seeing some great films and writing about them. We're going to have some beautiful portraits and some beautiful stories coming out of that. Check that out online and on newsstands. We'll be back next Tuesday. Check us out. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you listen. Thank you for joining us here. Thank you, Pia. Thank you, Bill. And on behalf of all of EW, happy awards season. Go see some movies and let us know what you think about them. Thanks so much.